Welcome to Let's Talk New Mexico. I'm Sarah Gustavus. This year's 30-day legislative session wrapped up last week. It was a budget year, but lawmakers also considered legislation to address issues like education and public safety. Do you have a comment you want to share about the outcomes of this year's 30-day session? Did lawmakers address the issues you care about? Join our conversation today by calling 277-5866. You can also email letstalk@kunm.org. We'll start with what happened at the Roundhouse in Santa Fe this hour, and then we're going to look back at programs and organizations around the state that are addressing some of the most persistent problems in our communities, from poverty to a lack of access to health care. I'm joined in the studio this morning by Dee Dee Feldman, a former state lawmaker and author of the new book, Another Way Forward, Grassroots Solutions from New Mexico, and Dr. Mariah Heredia-Griego, director and assistant research assistant professor at the Cradle to Career Policy Institute at UNM, formerly the Center for Education Policy Research. Dee Dee, I'm going to start with you. I've heard a lot of folks say not much happened this year. Do you think that's an accurate summary?
Well, they had more money to work with this year, I think $300 million new money, but they used most of it to backfill the shortages that they had created by sweeping a lot of funds from different programs and not giving raises in state government or for teachers or for state police and so on. So I don't think there were any major initiatives that passed this time. In fact, several failed. The early childhood one failed again. There were a few good things, I think, in terms of nursing and in terms of guardianship reforms. That was a plus. The lottery was changed a bit to a flat fee for each student rather than a percentage of the take from the lottery. But, you know, we still have a long way to go to make up for the cuts in higher education, in particular, about 11 to 15% of UNM and other higher education institutions' funding was cut over the past 4 or 5 years. And of course, we remember the veto of all of higher education last year. But it was a more convivial session for sure. But I didn't see anything really, really big and significant coming out of there.
And Mariah, what about you? You were watching maybe education bills. What caught your attention this year?
One of the things that we were looking at this year was around child care subsidy and child care assistance in the state. That was a really big, great conversation. When we think about the supports that families need, we know that the early childhood, the science behind early childhood education is there. We know that there's been investment in that, particularly around pre-K. But we're also thinking about families as a whole. So we were watching very closely the child care assistance support and the type of wraparound services that allows for parents to be able to work or go to school that can actually also provide the opportunity for them to access things like high quality pre-K that is not a full day. So child care assistance was a big one for us.
Teachers, though, did get a boost in pay in the budget. We're waiting for that to be signed by the governor. Mariah, does that make a difference? Does the research show that raising pay for teachers will make a difference in the classroom?
Well, we know that we do have we are watching the quality implementation. And so tied to quality is definitely the education and the professionalization of teachers. And not just teachers, but we're also looking to very heavily at the early childhood workforce. We have a lot of young, talented folks who need a living wage and also need to have access to professional development opportunities. And again, they're taking care of our most precious resource, our children, every day. So we do really want to be able to see those wages reflect the work and the importance of the work that they do.
Dee Dee, what about state workers? There was a lot of talk about, as you mentioned, that there hasn't been raises year after year. Anything different this year?
Well, as I say, I think they're just kind of backfilling and bringing it up to the level that it was before. Really, you know, state workers and public employees have really borne the brunt, I think, of this recession in terms of not of just staying steady while all the other costs have gone up in terms of health care and in terms of everything, really. So, you know, I'm hopeful that state workers will fare a little bit better, but it's not a big leap.
Mm. For folks listening today, have you been following the legislature this year? What do you want to share? What do you want to talk about when it comes to the legislature and what lawmakers accomplished in this year's 30-day session? The number to join us, 277-5866. You can also email letstalk@kunm.org. And Dee Dee, as a former state lawmaker, do you think that there was true bipartisanship this year? I've seen a lot of people say it was bipartisan in a way that it hasn't been in a long time.
Well, I think there was more communication. And that's should have happened years ago. So it was calmer. The stakes didn't seem to be as high because there was new money. So you know there won't be a special session. But I didn't think that other than really one big controversial issue, which was the San Juan coal plant. There was not as much acrimony. They seemed to be on the same sort of crime-fighting page. And, you know, whereas the governor in the past, though, has just focused on increasing penalties as a way to solve this problem, this time there was an omnibus bill that included workforce as well as some enhancements for crimes that are committed with firearms, but not everything that the governor wanted, not everything that the legislature wanted. So that's the way it should have been the whole time. And for some reason, it never seems to be that way.
Do you think also because it's an election year, the House is going to be up for election, governor is going to be up for election, or we're going to have a new governor because Governor Martinez has served two terms and can't run again?
Usually that makes it more acrimonious.
Really?
In my experience, yeah. Usually that makes it more acrimonious, particularly if there are people within the legislature who are running for higher office. And I think in the Senate, that's more common because, you know, senators run every 4 years and don't have to give up their seat when they run for lieutenant governor or when they run for governor even. So it can be or attorney general or one of those state offices. It can be very acrimonious the year before an election. But in terms of the governors, and the governor being a lame duck, there's a little less percentage in the governor pushing ideological issues.
Yeah. Mariah, one bill that caught my attention is it would have required seniors in high school to sign up for college, the military, or an internship or apprenticeship in order to graduate. The sponsor, Representative Nate Gentry, pointed to some cities in Texas that have enacted similar requirements. Chicago has also done this. Does this strategy work to get students across the finish line to make sure they earn a diploma?
Well, I think the aim and the intent of the legislation was a good one, right? We want to be able to see, we want to know what kids are going to be doing after, and we want to actually connect them with those opportunities. I think where we get a little bit stuck and maybe there needs to be definitely some more conversation about is, do the schools have capacity to be able to serve and meet this need in a fair and equitable way? So that way every child has access to every opportunity equally. And also, I think the other question is that we already have students who are struggling to get across the graduation finish line. And so are we putting another check mark, another box for them to check on their way out the door? And is that really the best strategy? Or should we be looking a little bit further into their high school years, maybe around junior year, to be thinking about internships and applications? We've also seen in other states where states fund ACT and SAT prep programs for students. And those have also seen great success. But it also needs to be coupled with the resources to be able to support them to be successful in those endeavors.
And should we maybe even go back even earlier to middle school? Doesn't some of the research show that talking with students about where they're headed, what high school is about, what a career is about in middle school actually makes a difference?
Absolutely. And I think, you know, we can go all the way back to home visiting and prenatal, right? We know, particularly at the Cradle to Career Policy Institute, right, that all of these initiatives are connected, and a child's educational experience doesn't just begin in 1 year or where we start to legislate an initiative, but we have to be thinking about the entire continuum and how all of the pieces work together as a system to support our students in their education.
Great comments about legislation. If you want to join us today, the number is 277-5866. You can also email letstalk@kunm.org. We're going to go to a quick break, and when we come back, we're going to talk about some big ideas for improving life in New Mexico, programs that are working across the state and looking at why they're working and how they might be expanded. This is Let's Talk New Mexico.
The law firm of Rothstein Donatelli is committed to supporting KUNM. Since 1976, the firm has litigated Native American law, criminal defense, wrongful death, and civil rights in New Mexico and nationwide. Info at rothsteinlaw.com.
Support comes from PREA America, offering audits and consulting for the Prison Rape Elimination Act, which protects vulnerable incarcerated populations like women and children. On the web at PREAAmerica.com, PREAAmerica.com.
At the height of World War I, Carl Nielsen wrote a piece that, in his words, would express what we understand by the spirit of life, everything connected in one great stream. Nielsen's Symphony No. 4, his inextinguishable symphony, on the way in concert, on the next Performance Today from APM.
Weekday mornings at 9 on KUNM.
I'm Sarah Gustavus. This is Let's Talk New Mexico. We're talking about the legislature and big ideas for improving life across New Mexico this hour. You can join us by calling 277-5866 to tell us about a program in your area. We have Ona Porter on the line. Ona is the CEO and president of Prosperity Works, which offers training on financial resources to help people save money through individual development accounts or IDAs. Ona, you've been doing this work for a while, and you go to the legislature every year. What happened for Prosperity Works this year up in the Roundhouse?
Good morning. Yes, Sarah. One of our requests was for $500,000 to support the IDA program that we administer statewide. And individual development accounts are match savings accounts, and participants take 10 weeks of financial capability training, and then they're eligible to save. When they reach their goal, we match them 4-to-1 for the purchase of a first home to capitalize a small business or for post-secondary education. And this is allows people to move out of poverty in 18 months. And the federal money has now been cut from the budget. We have brought $4.5 million of federal funds to our state. But every one of those dollars has to be matched locally, dollar for dollar. And if we can't count on state money to help us with that, it becomes extremely difficult to raise the funds that are necessary to continue this program. There is, in our opinion, no other initiative that really frees people from poverty in that period of time, and at the same time builds local economies.
Tell me about, what do you talk to lawmakers about when you go to kind of pitch what you're doing to help people move out of poverty in New Mexico? What examples do you share with them?
Well, what we really talk about is very specific, usually to their districts. And, you know, the results that we have. So, for instance, over about the last 10 years, there have been 330 families that have purchased homes. And a purchase of a home is not just a place to live. It really is seeding yourself in a community. And when you do that, you become a part of a community in a very different way than if you are a renter. In addition to that, your children do better in school, and the family is stabilized over time. This is really critical. Mm. The other thing is there are about 700 New Mexicans who have achieved some level of post-secondary education. And with that, they have an aggregate annual income increase of about $5 million, which they're spending in their communities. And the other thing is, we talk about jobs, jobs, jobs all the time. Well, there have been over 600 businesses created with the IDA and almost 2,000 jobs. And about 60% of that is in rural and deeply rural New Mexico, which frequently gets neglected. So those are very compelling statistics and very compelling arguments for investing in New Mexicans. We would like to see if we said, you know, you take 1% of the governor's closing fund and invest it in New Mexicans and see what happens. These are jobs that don't get exported.
Yeah,
these are real jobs and real people and building real communities.
That closing fund is a pool of money used to try to recruit out-of-state companies to come to New Mexico and set up shop here. Ona, I know I've heard before that some lawmakers and former lawmakers say we should really look at programs that are working, evaluate them, and invest in them. How do you measure success? What can you take to lawmakers and to demonstrate the success of the IDA program?
Well, Sarah, it's not just the IDA program. It's also our Prosperity Kids program and other initiatives that we do. We have set the gold standard in the nation. 90% of our IDA participants are successful in reaching their goals and purchasing their asset and leveraging those assets for their futures and their families' futures. And it is not we have data that is from here to next week. But lots of that data is actually done by outside organizations. So, for instance, most recently, the IDA program was part of a field test on the effectiveness of IDAs. And with that, we opened 153 accounts in about 18 months with CNM students. And community college students are very fragile financially, you know, in the norm. And 153 other students were eligible, but did not participate, were not chosen. They were in the control group. And those 153 students who got an IDA, 87% of them were retained to their degree or their certificate. Now, that's a huge opportunity for the community college and for the students who are participating there. With our Prosperity Kids initiative, we have it's a child savings account, and we in our pilot, which is being evaluated by Dr. Willie Elliott at the University of Michigan, who is the guru on the relationship between assets and education, and our pilot program participants, 521 kids in the South Valley of Albuquerque and about 300 families, has the highest savings rate in the nation, which is a critical affirmation of our belief that the opposite of poverty is not wealth, it's opportunity and social justice. And when we put those things in place, we can win. And to continue to neglect investments in our children and our families is to continue on a path of a future that is not unlike the current and past, which is one of poverty. When we know what to do. We know how to do it, and it does not cost too much.
Do you think that next year might be different when you go to the legislature again?
Well, you know, we are always hoping for a different outcome and working to achieve different outcomes. And, you know, in the last session, we actually had House Memorial 64, which set up a task group to look at public funding for our Prosperity Kids initiative. We've got, you know, the data that says this is something that works. Kids who have an account in their own name are four to six times more likely to go to college than kids who don't have an account. And that was with $500 or less. Our approach is much more robust than that, but we can't continue to expand this because in our approach, we're not only opening accounts with $100, we're matching those up to $200 a year for 10 years. And with that, we can't make a commitment to a child that we can't keep. And without public money, that entire $1.25 million budget that was invested in the pilot was all raised privately. and except for one $25,000 grant from the city of Albuquerque. So it's time now for public funding, and that was the purpose of the task force. And our state treasurer, our state auditor, state investment council, where all kinds of folks were involved in this, and now we are putting the fine point on a proposal for the next legislative session. You know, we always hope that those are the things that are going to make a difference.
Well, Ona, we appreciate you calling in today. Ona Porter from Prosperity Works. We'll keep an eye on your programs, keep talking with you about the legislature throughout the year. Thanks for calling in today.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Dee Dee Feldman, former state lawmaker and author of the book Another Way Forward, you've looked at organizations like Prosperity Works across the state to address these persistent problems. What did you look for when it came to success for demonstrating that they're working?
Well, I think one of the things that Prosperity Works does that is characteristic to a lot of the successful organizations is it builds on existing assets. And in this case, it very directly builds on the assets, even if they're very small, that a family might have and uses those assets to create a mindset that can lift people out of poverty. And the statistics are there. She told you, I think 2,000 jobs, 600 businesses, people buying homes and finishing their degrees. It's a way of lifting New Mexico up off of the bottom. And you can only do that when you really address poverty, you address New Mexico where it is now and not trying to make New Mexico like some other state by attracting big corporations or hoping that the wealth will trickle down somehow. I'm really impressed with Prosperity Works. And, you know, they've come up with something that should be supported by the public sector.
Well, why, though, lawmakers, it seems like, don't spend a lot of time talking about programs like that. Any program that's working, the discussion is just somewhere else. Why is that?
Well, poverty is a big problem, and trying to figure out how to get a handle on it is not easy, especially with the limited funds that that New Mexico has had during the past couple of years, and we've been sort of spiraling downward because we are not making the investments that we need, even if they're small strategic investments that can be made. So a lot of these folks walk away empty-handed, and that's really a bad thing.
This is Let's Talk New Mexico. Do you have a big idea for our state, a program or strategy that you think would be a game changer and help us address challenging issues like poverty? Tell us about it. The number is 277-KUNM. That's 277-5866. We're also live tweeting the show. You can send your comments with the hashtag Let's Talk NM. And we have someone from another program that you highlighted in your book, Dee Dee. Dr. Sanjeev Arora is in the studio with us. Dr. Arora is the founder and director of Project Echo. Welcome.
Thank you, Sarah, for this opportunity.
Project Echo was created in 2003 to address a lack of access to specialty care for New Mexicans in rural communities. What happens when a doctor or patient signs on to the Project Echo system?
You know, what happens is that patients who are in rural areas have a very difficult time accessing specialty care in New Mexico. Sometimes they have to drive hundreds of miles. And in my case, I'm a specialist in hepatitis C. When I started this project in 2003, patients would be driving 200 miles sometimes, 12 times, to get one course of treatment while they were getting a chemotherapy-like regimen. And of the 28,000 patients that had been diagnosed with this disease in New Mexico, less than 5% had been treated. And the result was that low-income patients had no chance of getting treatment. So what ECHO does is it allows the right knowledge to be present at the right place at the right time so that the right care can be delivered at the right place at the right time. We know that without the right knowledge, it is impossible to get the right care. So what we do, and what we did in this particular circumstance of hepatitis C, is we create expert specialists in hepatitis C all over New Mexico. And we have close to 30 of them now in every part of New Mexico. And they join us in a weekly, what we call tele-echo clinic, where they present patients to us and to each other, real patients without their names or identifiers. And our experts at the university in an interactive video conference, much like Hollywood Squares, gives them advice. And we call this all teach, all learn. And what we found was that these doctors rapidly become experts in treating hepatitis C. It takes about 12 months of these weekly clinics. But as a result, patients can now be treated in their local communities. And the wait in my clinic, which started off at 8 months, over a course of 18 months, fell to 2 weeks. And even today, in my hepatitis C clinic at the University of New Mexico, you can be seen within 2 weeks, and anywhere else in New Mexico, you can get treatment for hepatitis C.
So maybe the most severe cases would come to Albuquerque and see you, and you could focus on them.
So, Sarah, that's exactly the point of ECHO, is what we call an effective triage system. When the primary care clinician does not have all the knowledge, every patient with hepatitis C has to stand in the same line because there's not the ability to distinguish between the ones who really need to come to Albuquerque and the ones that can get care there. What ECHO does is it rationalizes the system. As I said, the right care at the right place at the right time. And some people just need care at the university. So they jump ahead of the line and can actually get an appointment quickly as opposed to waiting many months in the regular line.
Yeah. Now, does this save the state money?
There is very substantial information now we have. So ECHO has been evaluated around the country. We now have ECHO projects out of more than 170 academic centers for more than 60 disease areas in 25 countries. And there is data that ECHO can save money in many different ways. It saves travel cost for patients. So if you have if you're a low-income patient in New Mexico, you have Medicaid. And Medicaid pays for your travel to come to Albuquerque, and it can be hundreds of dollars per visit of travel costs. It also saves unnecessary testing, because when the primary clinician knows, has the right knowledge, they can directly get to the diagnosis as opposed to doing very large numbers of tests. Third, treating patients early prevents the cost of untreated disease later on. And fourthly, often because there are no specialists in rural areas, patients will often go to emergency rooms because their problem is not tackled. And so there are unnecessary admissions that can be avoided. And we have evidence for all of these in multiple studies around the country now.
Yeah. There's really something at stake there. I mean, New Mexico spends quite a bit of money in our budget for Medicare. We have a lot of New Mexicans on Medicare and Medicaid. So this is something maybe lawmakers should be talking about more, of how to make that an efficient program, bring down costs.
So the legislature, and Senator Dede Feldman was one of our great supporters when she was in the New Mexico Senate, has been extraordinarily supportive of us over the years, and we are certainly grateful for their support and recognition of how ECHO can help New Mexicans.
Dr. Sanjeev Arora is with Project ECHO. We're talking about big ideas for New Mexico today, things that lawmakers might consider maybe in interim committees this year as lawmakers continue to meet to talk about future legislation. We're wanting to know why things are working, what can be expanded. Do you have a program or an idea you want to talk about today? The number is 277-5866. You can also email letstalk@kunm.org. I'm Sarah Gustavus. We're going to go to a quick break, and we'll be right back.
If you loved your car or your truck or RV, but it just doesn't do for you what it used to, don't feel bad. By donating it to KUNM, it will give you a great feeling again, knowing you've done a wonderful thing for the community. The folks at our Vehicle Donation Center arrange for a tow truck, title transfer, and handle all the details. One call and you can keep that love going. Call 888-KUNM-CAR. That's 888-586-6227.
time to interrogate what host of Native America Calling. And Therese Marie Millott is our February Book of the Month author. On our next program, we'll visit with her about her memoir, Heartberries, and why she decided to open up about her life that counters a romantic view on what it means to be Native. We hope you'll join us.
Weekday mornings at 11 on KUNM.
And this is Let's Talk New Mexico. I'm Sarah Gustavus. We're talking now about big ideas for improving life across the state. I'm joined in studio by Dee Dee Feldman, former state lawmaker and author of the new book, Another Way Forward, Grassroots Solutions from New Mexico, Dr. Mariah Adia-Griego from the Cradle to Career Policy Institute, and Dr. Sanjeev Arora from Project Echo. Mariah, I want to go to you next. What does the research show are the most effective strategies for increasing graduation rates? That's a big one when it comes to education in our state.
So, again, I think some of the biggest conversations that we're having right now is thinking way early down the pipeline. Early childhood being one of the starting points. We know that a child's cognitive development is happening way before they get to kindergarten, and that's one of the most impactful ways that we can reach and support children to be able to be ready to learn in their schools. We are also thinking about again, supporting families through childcare subsidies so that way parents can be able to go to work and go to school. We did see an uptick of folks accessing childcare subsidies in the state for the purposes of going to college, which is a great thing. We're also looking down the pipeline at post-secondary degrees, post-secondary credentials for adults in our community. When our adults and parents are educated and have access to a living wage, we know that they can also be better parents in the home. They're less stressed, and we know that children are in safe childcare environments. So all of these are interconnected and interwoven. We know that if we're looking at high school graduation, in high school, it's a little too late. We're losing students way prior to even getting to high school, and those are some of the biggest challenges. We also saw lots of conversation this year around legislation, through legislation, legislative conversations, but bringing in some of the most recent tragedies and of loss of children in our communities. And, you know, a lot of questions around, where did the system fail? Who was supposed to check on them? And these are all really great questions. Although we're upping our investments in a number of different initiatives, it's not enough to pick one and put money in just one investment. We have an entire system that has cracks in it that needs to be lifted up and woven together.
It's really challenging in just a 30-day or 60-day legislative session to get that conversation going all at once.
Absolutely.
What about there was another proposal again this year, it's a bit year after year, of advocates want to tap the permanent fund to support early childhood education. What needs to happen to make early childhood programs as effective as they could be to reach their full potential?
So absolutely, resources is what's needed. And the land-grant permanent fund is the one that is actually the most robust and saying, let's invest in the entire continuum and in the entire early childhood system. Everything from home visiting, I mean, the things that we know work well around pre-K, not pre-K just for four-year-olds, but also for three-year-olds. We know that 2 years of pre-K has significantly different outcomes for kids. Voluntary full-day pre-K, all of these things take tremendous resources. Although we are, one of the top in the country, we had Dr. Deborah Phillips, who's a psychology professor from Georgetown, was a visiting scholar with my center a couple of years ago. And we know that, 70% of our school districts currently have pre-K, and we need to move that to 100%. We can think differently about how we interweave with federal resources around Head Start. And none of this is saying let's put money into the system and not assess it. We're saying let's invest in the best strategies across the continuum, including K-3+, extended school days, extended school years, pardon me. And let's continue to assess the impact and monitor the changes as we move along, because we also know that just because it worked well in one place, there are going to be nuances in our communities, with tribal communities, rural communities, that have particular needs that the programs could look different. And we need to have a system that can be adaptable to meet the needs and the best strategy, provide the best strategies for our communities across the state.
If anyone's listening to Anna's questions about education and what the research shows, Dr. Mariah Heredia-Griego can answer those. The number is 277-5866. We have a Twitter comment from Krista. She says, transform the lottery system into a subscription so people don't have to stop at a convenience store but can purchase a set regularly and log in to see if they've won, like a charity with benefits. That's an interesting idea. We also have a call now from Emily in Santa Fe. Emily, what do you want to add to our conversation?
Hi, thanks so much for letting me join in. I just wanted to share about a program called LEAD, which is, stands for Law Enforcement Assisted Diversion. And what this program is, it allows law enforcement officers to redirect people suspected of involvement in low-level crimes, such as like shoplifting or possession of drugs and paraphernalia, to case management and social services and treatment pre-arrest. So it redirects them from jail and directly hands them to an intensive caseworker. And we're doing this in Santa Fe. Santa Fe became the second in the nation to implement a LEAD program. There is interest around the state to replicate it. And we're seeing great results in Santa Fe. So far, early evaluation shows a decrease in recidivism back into the criminal justice system and a 47% decrease in jail costs. So, and these evaluation results are mirroring what Seattle's seeing. This is a great way to take problematic drug use out of the criminal justice system and put it in a health-based system. It's an incredible public safety program, and we're hoping that it can be replicated. There's a appropriation in the final legislative or in the final bill that's on the governor's desk to provide some funding for Las Cruces and Albuquerque and Santa Fe to replicate, and so we're hoping that'll happen. But it's just an incredible, promising practice that now their LEAD program's operating in 12 states, and 8 programs are about to launch around the country.
Emily, thanks for calling in today. That's exactly the kind of program that we were hoping to hear about, these ideas of what's working, why is it working, what can we learn from it. We'll look into that some more, the LEAD program. I've also covered recovery courts, which are a way to divert people into a program where they can get some treatment for, say, alcohol abuse or drug abuse. We're going to go now to Joel. Joel, what would you like to add to our conversation this morning?
Yes, can you hear me?
I can.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I'd like to add, you know, the more transparency probably in, in the form of government, because last year we were told that there wasn't too much money for education because the price of oil and fossil fuel, whatever, was down. This year, all of a sudden, we're standing a little better, thank God. But, you know, I think there has to be more transparency, really, and more accountability, and, like I said, more programs being made available. I was really astonished that, you know, that this year our financial outlook was a whole lot better. And I was like, well, you know what? Price of oil hasn't really, it's actually maintained or actually stayed the same. So, you know, we need more transparency, definitely, definitely. As far as that, and more accountability, and more programs being like the last two callers, as far as, you know, for the education at the lower levels and onto the higher levels, and then we need more enforcement in school safeties. And, you know, hopefully the gun issues will get addressed a little more stringent. And, you know, drastic times call for drastic measures, you know, and we might even have to get a little tougher and then go on some hunger strikes and try to get our laws, our outlook lookers to be able to look and say, well, you know, we really need safety in schools and take whatever measures it takes to be able to get our point across. Thank you.
Those are important points, and school safety is something that I'm particularly interested in and continuing to follow up on. Dee Dee, though, this idea of, you know, as you mentioned earlier this hour, lawmakers have to deal with so many issues at once, and there's not a lot of time. Do Do you have any ideas or suggestions for getting lawmakers to focus on maybe organizations, programs that are working, things like LEAD? How do you get their attention during the session?
Well, I think you have to focus on root causes, and that's difficult when you're dealing with crisis to crisis. So you can look through these programs, and like Project Echo and Hacia la Universidad, which is focused on what we were talking about earlier, and difficulties of getting first-generation college-going families prepped for that pipeline. You can look for common denominators. One of them that the legislature should, I think, be looking at is inequity. And how does inequity and unequal opportunity affect our state, and how do we address it? Sanjeev Arora deserves a lot of credit for addressing a basic inequity between rural areas and urban areas. That's a really significant health care inequity because, you know, there are just not the providers there in the rural areas. And the other commonality is cost, and this is something the legislature is more focused on. And once again, you know, the cost of bad education is criminal justice, jails, juvenile detention, the cost of high rates of chronic disease, as Dr. Arora points out, or increased admissions to the emergency room, and higher costs for everybody else in the system. So that's one thing that, you know, is a through line that I think legislators could focus on.
Dr. Arora, did you want to add something?
Sure. You know, I think that I just wanted to add that when you look at the data, the educational level of a student is one of the highest predictors of his or her health status. So in order to address that and the ECHO project, what we have done is first in the state of Wyoming and then in India and most recently in New Mexico, use the ECHO model not for improving health generally, but for training school teachers. And in fact, we have an ECHO project which has been launched recently, extraordinarily successful by one of our consultants, Dr. Mike Stanton. And this is for college readiness, college preparedness to increase graduation rates. And I see a major role for our project to improve education in rural and underserved areas of New Mexico, which will then contribute to better health.
Oh, that's interesting, those connections there. Any other ways that you see your model being used to kind of overcome challenges in New Mexico, or as you mentioned, Project Echo model is now being used in other states, other countries?
Yeah, I think that, you know, worldwide, it'll be used for even things like biological and nuclear and chemical weapon safety, and we partnered with Sandia National Laboratories on that. As I said, one of the biggest uses ultimately of ECHO is going to be in the field of education, training school teachers to be better teachers in terms of being mentored. We plan to use it in the environmental field, but the most exciting for us right now is we are partnering with the mayor's office here to use the ECHO model to improve public safety in the city of Albuquerque. And this involves an ECHO project where policemen are the learners. We have tested that earlier with an ECHO run by Dr. Dan Duhigg on crisis intervention ECHO, where policemen are being trained today on how to diagnose and mental health disorders when they stop somebody in the middle of the night. And so we call it our CIT or crisis intervention ECHO. And so we see many, many uses, and it's being there's veterinary science echoes now and others. Wherever there is a very focused area of knowledge which gets concentrated in a university or a city, our idea in ECHO is to democratize that knowledge, to bring best practices to underserved people all over the world with a goal to touch the lives of 1 billion people by 2025. And we are well on our way for that.
Excellent. Well, I'm going to end with, we started with the legislature. Lawmakers continue to do work in interim committees throughout the rest of the year. Mariah, what do you hope lawmakers will talk about when it comes to education in those interim committees?
Yeah, I do. I mean, among the myriad of program investments that need to be had, I think one of the most critical conversations that lawmakers should really take up is thinking about the integrated data system. We really lack an opportunity to be able to identify the most vulnerable children who are being touched by the criminal justice system and the foster care system and are also in our schools, so that way we can make the appropriate, practitioners can make the appropriate accurate referrals and follow up. I think that's one of the biggest challenges, is that some of our systems aren't talking to each other, and we need to be putting our children and families at the center of the conversation around how we share and understand data, early warning systems, and it's going to require us to take a look in the mirror at our systems and stop blaming the individuals.
Mm. Dee Dee Feldman, what do you hope lawmakers will be talking about in those interim committees?
Well, I'm hoping that the Health and Human Services Committee in particular can use some of the models here, like Project Echo, and apply them to some of our persistent problems like behavioral health and opioid addiction. I'm really heartened to know that Project Echo is working with the city of Albuquerque, and we need to have more community health workers, and I think a better use of our Medicaid funding to stimulate all these solutions.
We're going to follow interim committees. KUNM and KNME are working together on that coverage this year. If you have a program you want to bring to our attention, you can still email us at letstalk@kunm.org. Thank you to everyone who called in today to share your stories. The conversation doesn't have to end here. Use the hashtag #LetsTalkNM on Twitter, or go to KUNM.org where you can leave your comments and share the show with people you know. If you missed part of today's show, stream it online or subscribe to our podcast on iTunes. I'm Sarah Gustavus. Our engineer is Marino Spencer. Sarah Trujillo screened your calls today, and Victor Onimole live tweeted the show. Elaine Baumgartel is the executive producer. This is Let's Talk New Mexico on 89.9 KUNM.